Welcome to the program Study in the Chapel. God's Word is supreme at Chapel Ministries. We consider it absolutely essential to a proper relationship with God. We study it, we love it, we rely on it every minute of every day. The following program is an edited recording of the regular Bible studies we hold, and we decided to share these with you in the hope that you too will be able to find inspiration, encouragement, and ultimately salvation through discovering Christ in Scripture. Our intention is to travel all the way through the Bible. It will be a challenging journey, but one that will undoubtedly bring you to a decision. Through this study, you will be faced with either believing or rejecting what God has said to us. It is our intention to provide you with enough knowledge to make an informed decision about God and His Word. We strongly encourage you to listen intently and diligently, because though at the moment you may not realize it, these things are truly a matter of life and death. In fact, these are matters of eternal life and eternal death. Never treat what God has said lightly. There's truly nothing more important to you. Now, join us as we seek God's will through His inspired Word.
Before we went on that month-long break, we were immersed in the disturbing, scary, but admittedly fascinating story of Lot and his encounter with those two angels that God had sent to destroy the five cities of the Jordan Plain. That was a famously wicked place. The Bible tells us that the reports of the extreme sinfulness common in that region had reached all the way to the throne of God, and he was determined first to verify the reports of the wickedness. He didn't have to do that, but because he's just, that was phase one of his plan. And then when the reports had been confirmed, phase two would take place, which would be total destruction. So God himself comes down accompanied by two powerful angels. All three of them are in the form of men, so no one knows who they are at first. They stop by Abraham's tent on their way, and God himself lets Sarah know she's going to have a baby, which, as you can imagine, is the point that their true identities are revealed, at least they are to Abraham. Yes, I know that was the previous chapter, but as you remember, 18 and 19 are sort of part one and two of this story. Now, I'm racing through this. I apologize. If you want the details, you can go back to our previous recordings on the book of Genesis. This is 18 and 19. The part of the story we were covering the last time we were together is when the two angels went ahead to Sodom while God and Abraham have a little chat. God tells Abraham his plans for the wicked cities. Abraham, probably because his nephew lives down there, tries to get God to change his mind. God submits to Abraham's pleadings and promises to save the entire place if he can find only a few righteous residents. He agrees to spare the cities if his inquiries come up with at least 10 innocent souls. Chapter 19, the chapter we're covering now, opens with the angels, with the two angels arriving in Sodom. They are met by Lot. Of course, you remember Abraham's nephew, Lot. Lot greets them. Knowing how dangerous his town was for strangers, he begs the angels. He doesn't know they're angels yet. They look like men. He begs the men to stay with him for the night. He obviously fears for their safety, though he doesn't put it that way. The men at first resist, but eventually yield and agree to allow Lot to be their host for the night. Shortly thereafter, nearly immediately, the Sodomites arrive and show their infamous Sodomite ways and violently try to sexually assault the angels. Now, if this is the first time you're hearing this, you're probably shocked. Yeah, now you know how we felt when we heard it the first time. Lot tries to protect the angels for reasons we're still not sure, but we know things didn't go well for him. This huge crowd is so whipped up by their lusts that they actually ignore Lot's pleas in short order. As he's pleading with them to spare those men, he becomes intolerable to that crowd, and eventually they threaten Lot. They are so incensed by his persistent attempts to stand between them and those mysterious strangers that they tell him that they're going to deal with him worse than they were going to for those two angels disguised as wandering visitors. Well, this becomes too much for the angels, who are observing the whole thing, and they decide to use their divine power to rescue Lot from the clutches of the violent crowd. The two messengers of God somehow blind the rabble, allowing them the opportunity to pull Lot to safety. And with that, the angels apparently decide that they've seen enough. The Sodomites have clearly demonstrated that the cries against them are legitimate, and the angels begin preparations to destroy the city and its environs and warn Lot to get his family out. So let's pick it up now in the 19th chapter of Genesis. We'll start at verse 12. And the men said unto Lot, hast thou here, this is the angels, and the angels said unto Lot, hast thou here any besides son-in-law and thy sons and thy daughters, and whatsoever thou hast in the city, bring them out of this place. Verse 13, for we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. The betrothed boys don't take the warning seriously. And frankly, we're going to find out in just a few moments that even Lot wasn't all that enthusiastic about leaving. In fact, neither was his wife. The family had grown attached to the way things are in town. Now, they may not be involved in any of the shenanigans that were going on in Sodom, any of the shenanigans that makes Sodom, Sodom, but they don't seem to think it's all that bad. Their world has a strange hold on them, and frankly, they don't see what the big deal is. And by the way, this isn't so foreign to us, is it? Let me ask you, how effective do you think you'd be if you tried to get one of your relatives to get their lives, to give their lives to Christ by referring them to the gospel? I can see a few puzzled looks out there. What do you mean, John? I mean, how else would we preach Christ if we didn't refer to the gospel? Well, I'm talking about the true gospel, not the generic one we usually hear, not the having a gambling problem, Jesus can fix it kind of gospel. Can't seem to shake your addiction? Give it to Jesus gospel. The gospel of your wife left you, Jesus won't let you down. Those are nothing but marketing schemes that just use the word gospel, I suppose, because it sounds comforting. Can Jesus fix all those miseries? Of course he can, but not until you accept the true gospel. Which leads me back to my question. Would you feel comfortable describing to your family and friends the gospel and our need of it like Paul does? I mean, what does this have to do with Lot and the destruction of Sodom? Well, he had a tough message to deliver, and he got laughed at too. It's not easy to pass on a message from God. but you have to. Paul did too. Can you be this bold with your audience? Romans 1:16, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now that part doesn't sound too bad, does it? Well, how about this? Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold down the truth in unrighteousness. Do you think you have the guts? Do you have the guts to lay it all on the line like this? Listen to me. If you want to save souls, that's really the only way you're going to be able to do it. When you mention that the gospel protects us from condemnation, the typical modern person is going to think you're joking. Condemnation, please. You're kidding me. Why would God condemn me? I'm in no danger. Get lost, funny boy. Genesis 19:14, and Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. Actually, here is what it sounds like from the English Standard Version. The words are a lot less archaic and a little easier to understand. Genesis 19:14, English Standard Version. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. And listen, if you want a really good laugh, mention the devil. The other day, I had a 10-year-old tell me that there's no such thing as hell. And I got to be honest with you, it broke my heart. The reason so many people drown within 15 feet of the beach is because they don't believe in riptides. Riptides usually arrive when the surf is up, and that's when everyone wants to swim. We all want to frolic in the waves, but that's when swimming is its most dangerous. When times are good, when we're living our best life, we don't want to think that there's an actual devil out there tempting us to our ruin. Don't swim in the waves because there's a riptide today. What? That's a joke. I grew up on this beach and I've never had a problem. Cut to the scenes of the lifeguards trying desperately to clear your lungs of seawater. And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. When you don't fear God, you don't heed his warnings. If you live your life in constant pursuit of the shiny things, you're not going to notice the hook waiting to snag you. Verse 15, and when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. Now, here again, I'm just not getting a good feeling about Lot. I mean it. He's not bright. He's not very godly. He just seems so attached to this world he's cozied up to. It's the next morning, and the angels are still trying to get his family out. And while he lingered, what? Why are you lingering, Lot? What is wrong with you? I'll tell you what's wrong with Lot. He doesn't want to leave. Now, perhaps he's not as dismissive as his sons-in-law, but he doesn't seem all that eager to leave eager to leave and find a less wicked town to live in. Verse 16 again. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. I can't help but to chuckle a little bit because Lot is acting like an 8-year-old that doesn't want to go to sleepaway camp over the summer. These guys have to grab him by the hand and drag him out of the city, a city that's about to be destroyed. I mean, what a contrast this guy is to his uncle Abraham. God never had to tell him twice to do something. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city, the Lord being merciful unto him. At this point, listen to me, the only thing saving Lot is God's mercy. This is not God taking care of the righteous, I can tell you. Do you see any righteousness in this story? Uh-uh. A righteous man wouldn't have to be dragged into being obedient. And that's exactly what we have here. Those angels had to forcibly pull Lot and family to safety, not because they were unable, but because they were unwilling. And then we have these very famous, very detailed, and very necessary instructions given to Lot and his family. Verse 17, and it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad that he said, escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. H.C. Leupold put it perfectly when he said, quote, Lot's delay has made unbending haste a necessity. In other words, all the dawdling this guy has been doing for the past several hours has made escape a very pressing issue. Now, another thing I want you to notice is that God is not going to wrap you in bubble wrap and lock you safely away in the back bedroom somewhere. Lot is told to escape for your life. I find that fascinating. You see, at some point, Lot has to contribute to his own deliverance. God provides all the protection we need, but we must reach out and grab it. One of the possible dangers of fundamentalist thinking is descending into what theologians call hyper-Calvinism, which is basically the philosophy that whatever God is going to do, he's going to do, and there's nothing we can do or say to change it. It's a fatalistic view of our relationship with God. Now, we're not going to debate that here. But I will say that if that were true, then there'd be no need for prayer. Why would we ask God for anything if he's already decided everything? In fact, isn't he the one who told us to pray? I mean, here's a list of instructions for the Christian life from Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 5, starting at verse 14. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient toward all men, see that none render evil for evil unto any man, but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all men. Rejoice evermore. Pray without ceasing. Was Jesus wasting his breath when he told the apostles, Matthew 26, 41, watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. How about this one from Luke 18:1? And he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. Also, from here in the Old Testament, where we spend our Wednesday nights, 1 Chronicles 16:11, seek the Lord and his strength, seek his face continually. God sent angels to destroy the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah and much of the surrounding region, and Lot was told he could avoid the danger. Actually, Lot and his family could avoid the destruction if they chose to escape. He was told he must escape. In other words, neither God nor his angels are going to do the escaping for him. What's your point, John? Human beings are not automatons. God doesn't just pick us up and move us from place to place. Don't ask me to explain it any more than this, but God does expect us to act sometimes. He decided for some reason to leave some actions to our choosing. Again, choice might not be the right word to use here, but I can't think of another one. In the end, God is sovereign and grace is what gets things done. But the Bible makes clear time and again, he does expect some things out of us. Now, would Lot have perished if he had not left? I don't know, because that didn't happen. But what I can say is God is very good at getting us to do things he wants us to do. Yeah, we have free will, but God is very persuasive. All right, moving on. Now let's take these next three verses together, starting at verse 17. And it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad that he said, escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in the plain. In all the plain, escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. And Lot said unto them, oh, not so, my Lord. Behold, now thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. You know, I'm having a very difficult time liking this guy. It's really hard to believe that he and Abraham are related. At every turn, the picture that's drawn of this guy Lot is one of moral and physical weakness. Are these the words of a man who's receiving almost blind mercy from God? And I can't figure out if he's just whiny or he just doesn't want to leave Sodom because he doesn't believe God's going to go through with it. Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. As John MacArthur put it, an urbanized lifestyle was apparently superior to a lonely one in the mountains to Lot. He had become so accustomed to the perceived advantages of living in a city that he couldn't bear the thought of living up in that sparsely populated mountain. Again, this whole thing is just so distasteful to me. Instead of grateful obedience, Lot asks for a more pleasing rescue plan. Lot didn't want to trudge up that steep mountain where he certainly would have been the safest from the soon-to-arrive rivers of wrath. So he asks for a safe house that's a little closer and a lot more comfortable. He is a soft, weak, ingrate, and I don't like him. Yes, I know Peter says he was a just man, but I don't see any good qualities in him in this account. He must have had a change of heart later in life, but right now I am not a fan. Now, there are scholars who defend him by saying that this is simply Lot expressing some concern over the prospects for the success of this escape plan. They say he's worried he's too old or too infirm to make such a journey. Or he's sensing that the impending destruction is too close and that he would never make it to the safety of the mountain in time. They'll even suggest an alternate translation that goes something like, "I cannot escape to the mountain," the King James says, "lest some evil take me and I die." But their suggested translation would be, "lest that evil or the evil take me and I die, the evil being the destruction of the cities. Lot is perceiving that he can't make it in time, and he's suggesting a better plan. Now, the scholars who hold to this theory say that Lot is mildly, I guess, correcting these divine beings by suggesting that their plan is insufficient. He's not strong enough to make it that long of a distance at night, is his suggestion. Well, I agree with John Gill, who says this was owing more to the infirmity of his mind than of his body. After all, did Lot really think that God's handpicked messengers were unaware of the full extent and timing of their own plans of destruction? To me, this is at best a lack of faith on Lot's part. He simply doesn't believe that God is able to protect him. He never even seemed to consider that God would never suggest anything but the perfect plan. Even if Lot was too frail to make the journey, don't you think God would provide whatever he needed? I'm going to stick with my opinion, which is that Lot preferred to be in urban environments, and he was still not taking the danger he was in as seriously as he should. All right, so Lot offers up an alternative to this angelic yet inconvenient life-saving plan. Verse 20 again. "Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live." You all know how much we rely on H.C. Leupold for our travels through Genesis. Well, here's another reason to love this man. He's blunt and accurate with his assessment of these verses. He says, quote, "It almost taxes the reader's patience to bear with this long-winded plea at a moment of such extreme danger." Finally, an honest statement about a biblical character. Not much scholarly value in that thought, but it is refreshing to hear. Verse 20 again. "Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live." Now, this is a bit of an odd verse, if you ask me. Lot seems to think that the diminutive aspect of this nearby city would be enough to persuade the angels to allow him to go there instead of the mountain. He seems to be insistent on the fact that it's little. "Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live." It's near and it's little. Now, perhaps Lot chose that city purposely because it was little. Maybe he knew he was going to have to start all over in a new place since the city he was such a big shot in was soon to be ashes. Maybe he didn't want to linger too long in relative obscurity, and a small town would offer him a more expeditious return to his former or soon to be former prominence, big fish, little pond, and all that. Now, maybe I'm being a little unfair, but this just seems so weird to me. Are you saying the Bible is weird? No, I'm saying Lot is weird. This is an accurate description of the events of that day, but don't you think Lot is presenting an uninspiring, unpleasant even visage? He is completely the opposite of his uncle. Lot just seems desperate to avoid any discomfort. I mean, Abraham hated sinful behavior most of the time, but Lot seems to enjoy being around it. Again, I'm not saying Lot engaged in any sinful behavior. We have no evidence of that, but he seems to be drawn to these wicked cities. You know, this little city, Zoar, is one of the five that were originally to be destroyed because of their wickedness. Now, there are some that believe that Lot made a big deal out of the fact that this was a little city because he figured though it was among the five, it would be less wicked than the larger towns like Sodom and Gomorrah, that Lot emphasized this smaller footprint as a way to convince the angels that it wouldn't be such a bad thing if they spared it and allowed him to escape there. Now, I'm not too keen on that theory because if Lot wanted to convince the angels of the relative piety of the place, why didn't he use that fact instead of the actual size of the place? Makes no sense to me. Besides, listen, their whole job, the whole job of those angels was to come down and assess the region, and they didn't need Lot to fill in any blanks in their inspection report. No matter, whatever Lot's reasoning, for some reason, the angels relented. Maybe the angels were as wearied by Lot as we are. Most likely, there was no more time for this back and forth, so the angel is forced to be the bigger man. Verse 20 again, "Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live." Verse 21. "And he said unto him," this is the angel, "see, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow this city for the which thou hast spoken." The angel, who is not God, by the way, as some have suggested, gives in and promises to spare this little city, but he implores Lot to get there immediately. What must be done quickly. And that's where we'll pick it up next time. See you then.
We hope this study has blessed you. God's Word is a great treasure, and it's our belief that a thorough, purposeful study of it will bring all of God's children to an understanding of His eternal plan of redemption. It is our prayer that this will be so for all of our listeners. Please join us again soon. New content is being added all the time, so make sure you check back often. For more information on Chapel Ministries, including our YouTube channel and podcasts, please visit www.chapelontheweb.com. And if God has laid it upon your heart to share materially with us, we encourage you to follow the links to our secure giving page. Please note, Chapel Ministries is not an IRS-registered nonprofit organization, and your donations to this program are not tax-deductible. It's our hope that you do not rely on taxing authorities to decide for you who is worthy of your generosity.